pardon the brief interruption, but unfortunately we don't have enough time to listen to all these recordings in full. During the first week of the full-scale invasion, I had to spend a night at the Lviv train station. I arrived in Lviv from Uzhhorod in the evening after spending a week of pure hell trying to evacuate my family members from Ukraine. And since martial law existed, no one was allowed to leave the train station before morning. It was filled to the brim with temporary displaced people and refugees. It was musty and poorly illuminated. The train station walls reflected the disquiet hum of hushed but tense conversations around. And I desperately wanted to sleep, since I had barely slept the whole week, as you can imagine. But there was no place to lie down. There was no place to sit, even. At times, I felt like I might lose consciousness and fall asleep on the spot. And then a few hours in, I thought maybe listening to music would help me stay awake. It didn't actually help a lot, but I played a Notre Dame Mass by Guillaume de Machaut, performed by Ensemble Organum. They are known, as Grand de Lavoir, their raw, almost radical renditions of early music. But I think while it didn't help me stay awake, I think it performed a minor miracle, I would say. I put on my headphones, press play, and immediately with the first words, Sus capimus Deus, of the Mass, the whole train station transformed into a kind of a cathedral. It felt like all these people surrounding me were partaking now in some tragic but sacred event. And while I understand that when it comes to music, such power of transformation might be not as impressive in a peaceful time, it felt like a miracle, a real miracle back then. If the music written 700 years ago can transform a wartime reality now, when you don't know if you'll still be alive the next day or the next minute, I think it's quite an achievement. So let's listen to a short excerpt from this Mass. It is considered the first Mass written by a composer in Western music history, or actually the first kind of big work of a music composer. This is a bit problematic, since Machaut actually didn't exactly write the Mass in its entirety, just parts of it. But we'll have to leave such details aside for this talk. Okay. Later, while in Lviv, I discovered that many of my colleagues fled eastern central parts of Ukraine, as Lviv was and still is considered a safer city in the western part of Ukraine. Together with Michael Balak, Alexei Shmurak, and Ivan Kostik, they're all in this picture with yours truly, we organized a series of live-streamed fundraiser concerts featuring those musicians now temporarily relocated or displaced to Lviv. At first, we broadcasted their performances from Michael's Vedel School. It's an electronic music school and studio that is rather conveniently furnished with all the necessary live-streaming equipment. And I'm afraid we must thank COVID for that. But as the air raid alarms grew more and more frequent, and we had to postpone or cancel altogether several performances, we decided to move the next one, the next performance, and it was mine, since it was my turn to play, to the nearest bomb shelter. It was located about 100 meters from the Vajel school and lacked an internet connection that we had to provide with the help of two Ethernet cables joined together and shielded from the rain with a plastic bag. But it worked. I remember that when I rehearsed before the performance, the day before, I couldn't actually concentrate on music at all. It was rather difficult to endure the constant barrage of horrible news. And now, looking back, I think that what we were trying to do back then, our initiative, Life from Ukraine, and all these artists as well, maybe is actually preserve or recollect our artistic identities, because once the missiles strike your hometown, you don't actually know who you are anymore. I also thought about how bizarre the whole combination is, me performing on a modular synthesizer in a bomb shelter, music that is heavily inspired by Western European high medieval polyphony and monophony, as a Ukrainian army fundraiser. For someone outside, it might have looked like a weird Lynchian dream, each element seemingly out of place. But as I started playing the next day after my rehearsal, I felt like a musician again for those 20 minutes. And a friend of mine, Tatiana Voloshina, who helped with the organization, tweeted afterwards probably the most important review that I have ever received that seemed to transcend all these oddities and make sense out of all of them. She wrote that Heinola's music miraculously fits the bomb shelters and transforms them into a sacred space of Roman catacombs. While musically it wasn't the best of my performances, since then I have developed my form, technique, and the patch further. I hope that you will attend my concert after the talk. The patch is the way the modular synthesizer is set up. I invite you to listen to a short excerpt from it. So I hope that these three examples could, if not convince you, of the relevance of early music, but at least pique your interest in it. In the words of Björn Schmelzer, leader of the Grand Oliva Ensemble, and it's one of the quotes that I will present today of his, artworks of the past, just like contemporary artworks, dealt with the impossible, the traumatic, and the problematic in their own times. In this sense, they are trans-historical and can mean something to us today. It is in their relation to the impossible, the unacceptable, the unnameable, and the unknown that they speak to us today, transcending particular contexts and particular temporalities and becoming truly universal. It is precisely today, where they do not belong, that they are capable of producing meaning and of cracking the identities and master signifiers that we so desperately seem to cling into. So, what is early music? early in comparison to what exactly? In medieval times, the music that was performed was either contemporary or, in a sense, traditional. In the Renaissance times, the same. In the Baroque and classical times as well, they listened to contemporary music. That is the music that was primarily written by living, breathing composers. And then something happened. One of the ways of looking at it goes like this. The French Revolution of 1789 led to a radical break with the past, resulting in a traumatic birth of modernity. It's as if the continuous arrow of time has been broken and the part leading to the now ossified, objectified. Maybe some of you had this experience in your early childhood if you visited a big concert with a laser show when you thought, like me, that if you were just nimble enough, you might be able to catch one of the lasers, laser beams, and bring it home. Maybe put it into a vase, like a flower. The past has been broken off in this way of the ray of time, and now it has become something separate that we can hold onto. We can study it, put it into a museum, and play it in a concert hall. It lost its continuity with the present and became a ghost, a voice of the dead that would continue haunting us to this day. This event led to the birth of the so-called, among all other things, Western classical music canon, or Western classical music. After all, now we live in an era, a very interesting era, when most of the music we listen to, and music that is being played especially in the classical concert halls, is old music, music of the people long gone. But it was never like that before. Not long after, in the 19th century, early music was first kind of rediscovered, and then it experienced revival in the second half of the 20th century. Early music is music that appeared before the emergence of this classical tradition. There is no exact time frame, but I would say that most people agree that it starts from early medieval times, though some would include ancient Greek music, and we don't really know much about it. And it ends with the end of the Baroque era in the middle of the 18th century. For me personally, early music ends with the birth of the Baroque era, with the appearance of the first opera in 1597, just at the end of the 16th century. The reason is that affect theory, not effect, but affect theory, developed around that time, and it is essential for opera. Speaking roughly, it is a discipline about evoking specific feelings with music. As opera usually deals with many changes in the narrative and emotional states of the characters, music should be able not just to follow these frequent changes of states, but immaculately and unambiguously evoke any of them in a listener. This affect theory still influences contemporary popular music and film or video game music, electronic music even. So I would argue that we haven't trodden far enough from the Baroque era to consider it early music. But it's a controversial opinion. On the other hand, music composed before the Baroque era is entirely devoid of this affliction. I find it to be much more ambiguous, nuanced, and subtle, the qualities that I often find lacking in contemporary music. Let's, for an example, compare two great pieces of music, a Baroque one and a late medieval one. Adido's Lament, a 17th century hit Baroque aria by Purcell, performed by Voices of Music, and a 14th century motet by Philippe de Vitry, Quoniam Secta Latronum, performed by Sequentia Ensemble. 300 years separate these compositions, the same amount of time, actually, that separates us from Bach.
Thank you.
right, in the second one. So hear how the first example evokes quite unmistakable and ambiguous feeling of sadness, tragedy, maybe even impending doom. Still, the second example doesn't seem to manipulate us into feeling a specific emotion. It's not devoid of emotions. It's not just as manipulative. Moreover, instead of just one voice accompanied by instrument, as in the first part, telling one story, one narrative, expressing the feelings of one character, it has three voices that sing independently. Furthermore, they are actually singing different lyrics, each voice. This composition, called a motet, it is also a brilliant example of polyphony that I'm specifically interested in. Polyphony is precisely what happens in this music, in a motet. We have two or more voices or melodies that move independently. However, they don't necessarily have to sing different texts. It's just mainly specific to motets. The main idea is the independence of the melodic lines. Every melody can stand on its own. Let's now see how this music looks in its written form. What can we know, judging from the score? We actually can call this a score. The pitches, the rhythm, the lyrics, but we don't actually know the tempo, the tuning, or what kind of voices should sing this music. We also don't know if the singing is supposed to be accompanied by instruments. It resembles not so much a music score as we understand it today, but a kind of a diagram. Moreover, polyphonic music in the Western tradition started as an oral tradition, and the earliest manuscripts we have weren't actually intended to be used during the performances of this music. They were a kind of a reminder to help the singers recall music they already had in their memory. Needless to say, there was a lot of improvisation involved. While this poses certain difficulties in interpreting early music, it also offers quite a big degree of freedom. Moreover, and I tend to agree with Grand de Lavoie approach here, why not consider this lack of information as a way to ensure this music relevance in the future, in our times? What if we approach this lack of information as an intentional future-proofing of the work of art? After all, if we think about the ideal of a Gothic cathedral, it is kind of a work in progress that ideally is never supposed to be completed. And exactly by never finishing, if we can keep reactualizing it, we can keep it relevant. There are two general approaches in dealing with early music, as Björn Schmelzer notes. Survival and revival might then be understood as two ways of dealing with the trauma of modernity. Revivalism disavows modernity and imagines a return to the past, ignoring the fact that such a fantasy is only produced after passing through modernity, namely after a profound experience of alienation. It is a fantasy about what has been left behind, a homogeneous society, a harmonious past, and its equally harmonious cultural artifacts, not yet alienated from the symbolic horizon from which they emerged. Imagining that one might overcome modern alienation through renewed contact with, research into, and recuperation of what was lost, revivalism forgets that this phantasmatic production of what was lost is byproduct of modernity itself. After all, polyphony, that is, high medieval polyphony, wasn't at peace at all with its own time or symbolic culture. Judging from the amount of contemporaneous critique of this music, it was rather troubling, if not controversial, actually, phenomenon, as alienating as contemporary art to us. Its criticizers went as long as declaring singing polyphony an effeminate, which was a really big thing back then, bad thing, unfortunately, or even sodomitic practice, as Bruce Holsinger notes in his book Music, Body and Desire in Medieval Culture. Just a moment. Okay, I'll read it just. Already in early 12th century descriptions of polyphony, polyphonic counterpoint is conceived as dear friends who alternatively kiss, embrace, dominate, and adulate one another, friends who are ultimately arrived together at the copula. So there is very clear erotic, even sexual, subtext or context. And quoting A Threshing of Polyphony by John of Salisbury, a 12th century English bishop, in the same book, in the very sight of God, in the sacred recesses of the sanctuary itself, the singers attempt with the lewdness of a lascivious singing voice and a singularly foppish manner to feminize all their spellbound little followers with the girlish way they render the notes and end the phrases. Could you but hear the effete emotings of their before singing and their after singing and their counter singing, their in between singing and their ill advised singing, you would think it an ensemble of sirens, not of men. The high or even the highest notes are mixed together with the low or lowest notes to such an extent that the ears are almost completely divested of their critical power. Indeed, when such practices go too far, they can more easily occasion an itching of the loins than a sense of devotion in the mind. Quite something, really. So, as we can see, Gothic polyphony wasn't at all something at peace with its time. This is just a few of the examples of the critique that it received back then. It wasn't something purely functional as well. It wasn't Gebrauchsmusik, as if it were supposed to bring people closer to God. To reduce this music to this sole function would be a mistake. And now, how to work with early music, or how, at least how I work with early music. This is one of the reasons why I don't engage in the reconstruction of early music. My approach lies in borrowing and adapting certain techniques and methods from medieval music composers and theorists and from the more contemporary fields of analog synthesis and generative music. I'm an electronic music composer, and my instrument, after all, is a modular synthesizer. And I think it's time to talk about specifically my approach. In the past 4 years, I've been interested in early example of polyphony and monophony than we listened to here, so before the motets, especially in the organa of the 12th and 13th centuries, polyphonic compositions of the so-called Parisian school, or Notre Dame polyphony. So what is an organum? Organum is a time machine, and it has probably nothing to do with organs, with these enormous sonic marvels that were flexing the most advanced technology their age could offer, and, of course, unimaginable wealth and power. The earliest organ at Notre Dame was built in 1403, more than 2 centuries after the supposed lives of Léonin, that is, the composer of organs, the best composer of organ, actually, according to an anonymous visiting English student, sadly now forever known in history as Anonymous Four, and Perrotin, that is the best composer of discants. He wrote like his Quonium Optimus Discantor Erat. Discant is, roughly speaking, a type of organum as well. The term organum has more to do with the human voice, actually, as an organ, like a bodily organ, referring to vocal music. both Leonin and Perotin, as well as probably numerous other composers we know nothing about now, since they had a pretty different view on authorship in the Middle Ages, were faced with the challenge of writing contemporary new music back then. The beautiful and virtuosic compositions that could attract people to the new recently consecrated cathedral under construction. But what they were up against? Well, actually, they were up against popular festivals in the city that kept people away from the church. They went kind of out of hand, with Parisians merrily indulging themselves with all the alcohol, devilish dances, and all other stuff that happens during the wildest parties you can imagine. After all, it's medieval France. Imagine facing the task of composing liturgical music that could compete with that. But they succeeded. Let's listen to Widerunt Omnes, an organum by Perotin, performed by the Hilliard Ensemble. Organums were based on fragments of well-known plain chants, or also known Gregorian chants. They were called tenors, and they were time-stretched, quite a contemporary electronic music technique, actually, when you time-stretch a sound. They were sung nearly 10 times slower, or even more, holding every note. And you can see the tenor here.
Down.
You see this, like, fast, quickly moving upper notes, you know, and very slowly moving lower notes. And at the same time, the newly composed rapid upper voice melodies, they ran extremely swiftly and virtuosically with all the embellishments, bells and whistles that you can imagine. I think these are mystical machines, as the plain chants that were used in the tenors that were quoted, basically, they were well known to the audiences, not just melodies, but holy texts referencing particular religious meanings, senses, and ideas. And stretching these plain chants in time relative to the newly composed upper voices has the effect of witnessing an object nearing an event horizon of a black hole, or vice versa. If we take the perspective of the time-stretched plain chant, we are about to enter singularity, with all the light forever caught in the last photon orbit. Leonin and Perotin composed organa for human voices, the most timeless of all instruments. The human voice has existed for as long as we have existed as humans, and was our first musical instrument, human organ, and presumably will be our last. There is nothing like human voice in electronic music that would correspond to human voice, where any timbre that you use leaves kind of a secret double life of a semantic flytrap. It's promptly a deadly, it glues itself to the cultural context around it. Just how much easier it is to name the decade when a certain song was recorded just by hearing the electronic or electric timbres employed in it. Overdriven guitar in the heavy metal over the 80s, Hoover bass in the 90s jungle, etc. But I believe the nearest one could get to the timelessness of the human voice is by sticking to the basic waveforms building blocks of synthesis, of the very basic analog synthesis, the closest to timelessly neutral of all electronic timbres, triangles, saws, and squares. Then they pass through a filter, a shroud, or a stained glass window of a cathedral, balancing the energy of light. So this part, actually, I would probably leave to the Q&A, because it actually deals with my approaches. I just read and shortly comment on several, because it gets quite technical, and I don't think it's very, I don't know, it actually up to you whether you would be interested in that or not. Just ask if you think that I should talk more about technical approach, and I will do that. So generative monophony and polyphony. So instead of written down monophony and polyphony, I could write it, of course, by hand. I use generative techniques, that is, these melodies are generated in a modular synthesizer by a machine, by the rules that it follows. It's actually easier in modular synthesis to perform generative music than especially polyphonic or monophonic music, than a very strictly, composed music. They are very good at improvisation and randomizing stuff. But I follow in polyphony the main idea, that is the idea of the independence of the voices. So all the voices that are generated in modular synthesis, they should be independent. But they are not in the same relations as the voices are in the medieval polyphonic music. I use medieval music modes. So in the medieval times, the music theory developed almost outside of music practice. And in this music theory, they thought that they were referencing the Greek modes of music, the eight modes of Greek music, and they tried to adapt these modes to the plain chants that they already sung. And it led to some terrible events, but let's not talk about this now. I use Pythagorean tuning, but actually it's not really... It's something that you can read in Boethius or medieval people who wrote music theory. But we don't really know whether they actually used Pythagorean tuning back then. It's just an idea. I use cantus firmus or tenors taken from Gregorian chant. If you recall, I talked about the fragments of Gregorian chant stretched in time. Of course, in my case, they're not performed by people, but they are performed by a machine, so it's just a melody stretched in time. I use also medieval rhythmic modes in organa and talia in motets. So basically, it's an idea that you have a certain rhythmic pattern that you apply to a melody. So the melody, not just melody, it's a set of pitches. So they are kind of separately, they exist separately. Rhythm exists separately from the set of pitches, and you can apply it to it. I use also organum and discant structure. So there are certain parts of my performance that are based on so-called organum purum, that is the organum with slowly moving tenors and upper voices that are very fastly moving, quickly moving. And discant, all the voices move relatively fastly, quickly in relation to each other. In monophonic sections, I really like wide ambitus, so it's a range, it's basically a vocal range, a range of melody. That is, usually you can hear it in the music of Hildegard von Bingen. And yes, I use basic waveforms instead of complex timbres because, as I explained, I think it's they are the closest one to human voices in this regard. They have this closest relation to timelessness in electronic music. And I use filters, so I filter these waveforms as kind of a stained glass window, because music performances back then in cathedral, especially polyphonic music, it was not the usual performance, it was a celebration. So, for example, when we heard this Viderunt Omnes, it was specifically written for Christmas. So it was performed not so frequently. It was a very big event. And it was a multimedia performance because it featured also incense aroma in the church. It also featured the play of the light coming from the stained glass windows. It also featured costumes because all the singers were costumes. And it was creating a very certain atmosphere, all this was necessary to this performance. Okay, so I think this is it, and if you have any questions, please. No, it's not. Oh, it's okay. Not going to. I don't know why, because when I send this information, it's very specific. Mm-hmm. But my album, one of my albums that it was released in 2021, I think, Madrigals, it featured instruments. And I will work on my new album, Organum, that is based on this series of live performances. I plan to work with the vocalists to reinterpret this music, even like dive deeper, further. But actually, my idea is to reinterpret it from the point of the authentic Ukrainian folks singing. So it's a bit like complicated stuff. It would be very difficult to perform live as well, as I understand that. So my performance now would feature just me performing on a modular synthesizer and the wonderful work that from visual side that my collaborators did. Okay. But you know what I would add? When I worked on Madrigals, this album, and it was based more on the later Renaissance music, Madrigals, basically, it was quite funny to work with academically trained musicians. And I asked them to improvise over this. Some of them kind of understood what I'm trying to do, because I asked them, I have this like polyphonic, electronic structures that are generated on modular synthesizer, and I ask them to intervene their improvisation into this polyphony, as if this would have been a madrigal, you know. Some of them actually got it, some of them did not, but there was a really nice situation when Maxim Kolomyets, an oboist, he plays baroque oboe, he did not understand that at all, but when we actually started recording, the first take was absolutely perfect, and I told Max, "This has been absolutely amazing. Did you get it?" Actually, he looked at me with this like wide eyes and said, "Like, I have no idea what I did." I mean, and then after the album was released, he actually approached me and he told me that, "Oh, now I get it. I mean, yeah, this is how it's supposed to be." So I mean, sometimes it's just, you know, intuitive approach that that works the best.
Hi, thanks for your talk. My question was around, you talked a little bit about the medieval score and using that as sort of a roadmap rather than a literal thing. And I wondered about if you could talk about that in relation to your own practice in electronic music, or whether you see that in perhaps the video that you had that you took in the bomb shelter, or if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, medieval music score is more like a diagram. So it's not really like contemporary music score or 19th century music score, where everything is written down like up to the smallest detail usually. So it allows a lot of room to improvise and interpret. And this is very similar to actually to modular synthesis, because you can't really have a score when you perform. I mean, you can, but it would be an idiotic thing to do, probably, on a modular synthesizer. The patch, the way the modular synthesizer is set up, so the way the modules in the synthesizer are connected together, is basically your score. And it's very similar to this idea of a diagram, because it doesn't really tell you the patch. When I, for example, see someone else's patch, you know, I can't really know what type of music they actually play, but it kind of sets a set of rules, you know. It's like having like a garden, you know, that is being planted, but you don't really know, as what Brian Hill actually, his concept of generative music was very understanding it as a garden. So a gardener would plant seeds, and he wouldn't know actually what kind of how exactly these trees would look like, but he would know that over there there would be an apple tree. But what kind of apple tree, he doesn't really know. But it's inside these restrictions, there can be immense, infinite possibility of different, variants. So it is very similar in this regard to medieval music scores. But I don't, I analyzed, for example, I analyzed Perotin's music a lot, and I used some of the ideas that he had, but it's not so much about following what he did, than just using some of the, ideas and doing your own stuff, like creating new senses and meanings. Actually, his Vidur und Omnes score is quite reminiscent of Gothic cathedrals, because he always ends on this, what is called now a power chord, basically. It's like a fifth and an octave, and it's very heavily used to in heavy metal music, that you would have this like power chords. And he used it like, it looks almost like a columns when you look at this score, and when you highlight these columns, they start to look almost like a structure of the medieval cathedral. And these swiftly moving upper voices, they kind of reminiscent of the ornaments of the medieval cathedral.
Hi, Alec. Thank you for your talk. And you mentioned a lot of Paris School or Notre Dame School, and also Flemish, I could call it composers, yeah? Okay. And all this more like Western Catholic tradition. But do you find any influence on your work and et cetera in the more orthodox Ukrainian traditional religious music? Because as I know, it's also have a lot of, maybe not so early writings, but still a lot of chants and cants, and based on the Kyiv Mohyla Academy and the Stroke Academy, and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. Lately, as I mentioned, regarding my new album that I'm working on now, so I'm really interested in the authentic Ukrainian folk polyphony. And why, when I say authentic, it's a very specific thing that I mean, because during Soviet times, Ukrainian, there was by the Soviet regime, they created a kind of this phantom of Ukrainian culture that was completely sterile and completely safe, it's... but it was very different from actually what was happening in Ukrainian culture and what the roots of the Ukrainian culture. And now we have ensembles that try to reconstruct the authentic Ukrainian singing. It's polyphonic as well. And one of my latest mix for NTS2, it was just a few days ago they published it. It basically puts the... Ukrainian authentic polyphony performed by the Drevo ensemble in the wider context of Western European polyphonic music, sacred and traditional as well. There is also this weird dynamic when you talk about polyphonic music, it's usually people think that you mean sacred Western European music, but actually polyphonic music is very widespread in folk music, basically, and so it's interesting area for me. But my approach, it's not really it's just the music why I work with this music is because it does something to me that no other music does, and this is the most important stuff. I don't really try to understand why. I just follow it, So this, lately I've been delving into this Drevo ensemble, and it is very interesting to me. So maybe it's something that I would approach in the future as well. All right. Yeah, thank you so much for coming and listening. Thank you.
Worldwide.
Refuge Worldwide.
Refuge Worldwide.
Hello, I'm Morgan Sully, and for the next 2.5 hours, you'll be listening to live concert recordings from a project I got to work on with some friends called Latent Sonorities. Together with Jan Teja and Thaisa Raplansky, and in partnership with Haus der Indonesischen Kulturen, Rumah Budaya Indonesia, aka RBI, and Morphine Realm, we invited a group of international and Berlin-based artists to create new works using a newly created sample pack and tuning files recorded from a selection of Javanese gamelan instruments housed at RBI. The sample pack and album and tuning files are available free of charge via latentsonorities.org for anyone to use. Later this week, we'll be co-releasing these recordings as an album with local Berlin label LKW and Indonesian label Yes No Wave. Starting off our series of concert evenings is a live recording of Pinky Tut Aung, a self-taught multidisciplinary artist from Myanmar. She is classically trained in Burmese singing traditions and managed an experimental noise music community called Noise in Yangon, as well as being an active member of the band Buhinga. Pinky kicked off the concert series at Morphine Round on 15th of September, 2023.